Long distance, short fuses. Becky and I have been together for 7 years, and I'd say our relationship is the result of a very difficult try. In 2013, at the tender age of 25, and 2 years into dating Becky, I decided it was time for me to move from Chicago to Los Angeles. We had the expected heartache and stress in the months leading up to the move, and I just totally broke down on my last day with her in Chicago. We were going to try to go long distance for a year until Becky was ready to move herself. We started out the first month with lots of calling. We do the normal exchange of how our days went and how much we missed each other, etc. At some point early on, we realized that talking on the phone only bummed us out. For us, it put more focus on how lousy it was for our relationship, so we dialed it back to just 2 or 3 times a week and more constant texting instead. It made things a little better, but the sadness over not seeing each other really hurt. As anyone who has ever done long distance can attest, the time difference can be a relationship minefield. Becky would call me at midnight, her time on a Friday after going out, but it was only 10 for me, so I was only beginning my night. Then there's this whole, why are you going out and having fun instead of talking to me, sort of convo that couples have, an agonizing exercise I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. We fought from time to time and had some of those long, silent moments on the phone where it's clear both sides are hurt and unsure of what to do. And sometimes there's nothing to do. You just have to work through the pain and awful distance. Long distance is super tough, but having an end date to look forward to makes it a little easier. It's the light at the end of a really shitty tunnel. In all the years we've been together, we've only had a few big fights, which came out of arguments that escalated too far because of other stressors in our lives. Becky had a career change shortly after coming to LA, which took her back to school. She, at times, felt like she lacked direction, and I was super stressed with the trajectory of my own online video career. Sometimes these issues made us bicker with each other because we both felt overwhelmed by our new circumstances. I've learned, and am still learning, to treat each argument with care. Sometimes you should just agree with someone who is upset, even if you think they're wrong. And sometimes you should accept you are, in fact, the wrong one, and even though it's hard to admit, you probably should just apologize. What's most important for me and Becky is to remember that we're a team. And even though we aren't perfect, we've grown to understand one another's faults and know how to either not let them bother us or avoid bringing them to light. Moving on in. Moving in together is a big moment in any relationship, but for Becky and me, we were just so happy to be together again. However, we did learn a few things about cohabitating that we want to share with you. You're going to have to clean up after one another. Accept that. Don't try to make it a competition either. There will be times when it feels like you're the only one doing laundry or dishes or taxes or oil changes or whatever. Suck it up. You're a team. The what should we have for dinner conversation just became your life now. You'll have 95% of dinners together moving forward. Choose new recipes and restaurants often and push each other to try new things. If and when you see your partner is upset, listen to them and ask if they want your help. Sometimes people just need to be upset, and offering a solution isn't the solution. It's going to be hard, but if you're both well-intentioned, it will be okay. Most of all, have fun with your new roommate for life. Hopefully. The goal is to only get married once.
A lifetime of commitment.
There's a reason that I talk about Ariel so much. She is the love of my life, my best friend, and the most special person in my world. She's funny, beautiful, charming, intelligent, and incredibly talented. But what you may not see on camera is how strong and supportive she is. She is my rock. She keeps me grounded. When the entire outside world is a maelstrom of stress, she is a sanctuary of love and peace. We rely on each other so deeply. She makes the good times that much sweeter and the bad times a little easier. After nearly a decade of being together, I've learned that the true foundation of a relationship is daily commitment, love, and respect for each other. I sometimes see online comments about how our relationship and love for each other is so perfect. While I appreciate the kind words, believe me, Every relationship is tumultuous, messy, and real. It's got flaws and blind spots that a cute photo or a glossy filter doesn't ever see. We've had really difficult times through Wes going to the NICU or my knee surgery or Ariel's night classes for grad school, my midnight comedy shows, or when we got evicted from our sublet when we first moved to LA, evicted for subletting, ironically. Under the surface and through all the difficult times, it takes hard work. On our wedding day, we made vows to each other, but each morning when we wake up, we remind ourselves of those vows all over again. A wedding lasts a day, but a marriage lasts a lifetime. You can put that on a t-shirt. Pretty good t-shirt slogan. After Wes was born, it got harder to focus on each other. Suddenly, we didn't always have time or energy to connect with each other. When you're holding an infant, it can be a little difficult to have a deep conversation. So, we had to make time. During the day, when both of our energy levels are high, we find someone to watch Wes and then go out to lunch together. It's a little different from our Wednesday date nights because this is dedicated time to work on our relationship. We almost treat it like an appointment. How's it going? But like, how's it actually going? How you doing? How you really doing? How can we be more supportive? Are there difficulties we're having that we haven't been able to verbalize? How can I be the best partner for you? It's a focused environment where we're both 100% present. It was a little awkward at first to be so honest so quickly, but over time we've come to look forward to it as a time where we can address the issues that may get swept under the rug during day-to-day life. I've heard the saying, never go to bed angry. And while I think that is great advice in theory, it's nearly impossible once a kid enters the picture. The evening is when we're the most tired and least able to listen and process new information. So if Ariel and I are having a disagreement at night and something is left unresolved, we make a point to talk about it in the morning when we're fresh. As long as we don't let whatever it is get forgotten, we're much better equipped to resolve it together when our energy levels are high. I love and care for Ariel so deeply that I can hardly put it into words. She is the single most important person in my life, and I was forever changed the moment I met her. I don't know where I would be without her, and I'm so grateful that the foundation of our relationship is rock solid. I think the mark of a strong marriage is being cognizant of your issues and actively working on them. Getting through the good times is easy, but it's getting through the tough times that really forges a strong marriage. Because Ariel and I have been through so much and come out the other side more in love than ever, I know there's nothing we can't handle.
The Grinch. The Eugene that people first saw online, with his dry, sardonic humor and dauntless posturing, was not necessarily an act. It was the identity that I had developed in order to directly confront and combat my raging internal war. That Eugene, born out of necessity, became the basis for my more fully realized, moderate, current self. By being ruthless, inappropriate, darkly comical, and devil-may-care, I garnered the courage to embrace my work as an on-camera personality. On another level, I was able to avoid the opportunity for relationships or romance entirely, because anyone who came into my orbit would receive immediate signals that I was not to be fucked with. Like many artists, the most distinct, relatable parts of my personality were forged from my tormented process of constantly being othered, while reinforcing the notion that I am both incapable of giving and receiving actual love. I eventually did find a way to entrust myself into someone else's care and affection, and that relationship has emboldened my passions and philosophy on this subject for the better. but I regret to admit I still have doubts. I simply have never envisioned any relationship being able to stand the test of time. So is it really possible I'll be some glorious Shakespearean exception? With the influence of the other Try Guys, I can attest that I'm no longer as vehemently against lofty devotion ideals. And watching Ned and Ariel, Keith and Becky, and Zach and Maggie manage their relationships with steady, unabashed adoration has softened my Grinch heart, maybe making it grow the tiniest bit. Although the rampant PDA the Fulmers exhibit icks me out to the bone, I am all the better for being balanced by my friends, who are not only robust devotees of true love, but shining examples of its very existence. A Brief History of Trying. The King James Bible was first published in England in 1611 and was an instant hit. But a reprint that was published in 1631 had an eensy-weensy typo. One of the Ten Commandments is listed as, "Thou shalt commit adultery." So get at it, wives and husbands. At each other's wives and husbands.
Learning to be a BF. Relationships are always a work in progress. The idea that true love is easy and effortless is some fabricated rom-com nonsense. Being in a relationship is quite possibly the hardest thing you'll ever do, and it requires constant work. 4 months ago, Maggie and I moved in together. We share a beautiful, fluffy son/dog. We talk about the future, and if all goes according to plan, we're in it for the long haul. I found my person, and we're as happy as two people can possibly be, and it blows my mind basically every single day. I wake up, I look at her, and I wonder how I haven't totally messed it up yet. Growing up, I had a totally twisted view of intimacy. I imagined falling in love as the whirlwind of meeting someone new, the fireworks of your first kiss, the thrill of getting to know each other, and the electric nausea of saying I love you for the first time. But now that I've been in a relationship, I realize those moments aren't love at all. Love, actual love, is made up of a million unromantic milestones. Like the first time you ask the other to pop the pimple on your back, or when you debate for days over what color bedsheets to buy. Love isn't the first time your eyes meet across the dance floor. Love is the first time you fart in front of each other. Not at the same time, obviously. That would be nuts. Moving in together presented the perfect opportunity to deepen our intimacy. I've shed the emotional weight of the past and found the greatest girlfriend in the world. But as we enter this new stage together, I'm fucking really terrified again. Now is the time for me to evolve as a human, to take that next step as a boyfriend and as a person. And honestly, I really feel like I'm lacking the tools necessary to be a decent life partner. It really comes down to feeling like I'm not good enough. I think about the image of a family man, of a lover, partner, provider, and I'm not it. I'm 28 years old, but I still feel like a kid a lot of the time. I barely know how to take care of myself, let alone how to take care of another person. This feeling of not being good enough rears its ugly head in several facets of my life, but usually it's just me versus me. In this case, it's something that threatens to impact my relationship. I think about my trepidations about taking the next step, and it really seems to boil down to feeling like I need to get right before I can take care of someone else. I want more than anything to be that person. To be that person for us. So I know I've got some work to do. Basically, I'm a great boyfriend but a lousy roommate. And part of moving in together has included finding ways in which we're not immediately compatible. I'm told that's incredibly normal, but that didn't make it any less shocking. Maggie isn't just a neat person. She's the kind of person whose mental well-being relies on order in the house. To say that I don't care about staying neat doesn't quite capture it. I'm just not even aware of it. I'm like a baby who lacks object permanence. If I don't see things, I forget that I own them. Conflict brews. This is the simplest of possible disputes. Just clean up your shit, Zach. Yeah, I know. But it has predictably led to our first real fights as a couple. I am also aware that I'm prone to being, as the French would say, totally up my own butt. It's really easy for me to get consumed with my work, and I've had times where all I'm thinking about is myself. It's something I've been working on, but it remains a terrible trait as far as coupledom goes. Maggie is the absolute most important thing in my life, and I'm aware that there are times I could be better at putting her first. We're not talking about those grand romantic gestures I was obsessed with as a kid. We're talking about the little things. Small gestures every day that remind her how much I love her. When sitting down to write this book, I had to ask myself how my relationship could improve. At first, my pufferfish response kicked in, and I took it as a direct attack both from myself and from our publisher. But the more it sat with me, the more that question revealed itself as a universal prompt, applicable to anyone in a relationship, romantic or otherwise. Every connection in your life requires nourishing, and there's always room for improvement. You can't grow a plant without watering it. Trust me, I've accidentally killed every plant I've ever owned. After close inspection, it was pretty clear what I had to do.
Decent proposal. In this digital age, it's much easier to drop hints to your boyfriend that you want him to propose. However, I was still mostly oblivious. I would turn on my computer to a Pinterest page called Pretty that was just pictures of engagement rings. I think to myself, why is Becky always on Pinterest on my computer? And close the tab and get back to my normal computing. I know. After 4 years of dating, she asked me straight, are we going to get married or what? I was like, yeah, seems like we are. And she was all, then why haven't you gotten me a ring? And I was like, I don't know what kind of ring you want. And then she calmly said, I've been leaving an engagement ring Pinterest page on your computer once a week for 2 years. To which I said, oh, I just thought you liked Pinterest. I really did. So I started looking for a ring in earnest, but I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I asked my friend Hillary for advice, and she had a friend who's a ring broker. I should have known that meant she will bring expensive rings, but I didn't, because I have no frame of reference. It's not like when you watch Price is Right, and you know that Jif peanut butter is like $4 because you've seen the price in stores all your life. Nonetheless, I met with the ring broker, always following our philosophy of consulting with experts, and bought a beautiful ring I knew Becky would love. My plan was to propose around Christmas because we had planned to visit both families over break. I had the ring with me for the trip, but then her grandpa got sick and it just didn't seem like a good time to propose. It was a hard time for her family, so I kept the ring a secret. We came back to LA, and so did the ring, secretly living in a specific part of my backpack. I checked that pocket constantly to make sure I didn't lose it. The next available time was around Valentine's Day, but that seemed cliche. And then the postponing of it just made it harder and harder to figure out what to do and how I could make it a big romantic thing. I wanted it to be a special memory for her, even though her only request was that she, quote, wasn't wearing, like, sweatpants or something. Then it was March, and she brought up why I hadn't proposed and I had to maintain a poker face. I tried to make it seem like I hadn't even thought of it. Probably not the right move. In April, I figured I should just try another angle. That angle was just pick the next holiday and figure it out. So I told Becky that for Easter, it would be fun to do an Easter egg hunt, just the two of us. I woke up at 3 a.m., hid some eggs around our living room with candy and cute phrases, and then hid one egg that was impossible to find to ensure it was found last. We woke up Easter morning, and I sent her on the little quest. She found all the eggs, plus the ones with clues to bigger boxes of candy placed around the house. I said there were 14 eggs, but she had only found 13 and needed to try harder. Finally, I knelt down as she dug out the last egg and opened it. I asked her if she wanted to get married. She said yes, beaming, and then looked back at the ring and said, "Oh my God, how much did this cost?" I said, "Let's just say it's our family heirloom now." Also, since we went straight from bed to egg hunt, neither of us had put on any pants yet. So technically, Becky wasn't, quote, in like sweatpants or something. And now, we're married! It was the most fun wedding ever. Each Try Guy really played his part. Like, Eugene fixed so many broken boutonnieres and floral arrangement issues behind the scenes. Zach was running around greeting family members and shooting videos. Ned, beaming with pride as another Try Guy was finally about to achieve married status, was checking in with me and making sure my family was relaxed and having fun. Having them there, along with my best men, Brian Wool and Mark Musinski and my brothers, was really wonderful. We all knew that this was a big emotional moment for Becky and me, but it was also one for the Try Guys. We'd been co-workers and best friends, but groomsmen is such a milestone moment in a friendship, and having them there made the day just so much better. In my vows, I promised to continue to be Becky's friend, reminding each other that we are best friends and that we should treat each other as partners has been a key to our success. Marriage is both a relationship and a friendship. It's a bunch of little puzzles and efforts. It's a lot sometimes, but it's worth it. And I must say, having someone to share this crazy life with is pretty amazing.
Wednesday, date night.
Ariel and I have a date night once a week, and usually on Wednesdays because it's right in the middle of the week. We've been doing it since we first started dating, and it's the highlight of my week. Usually we go out to dinner. We love trying out new restaurants and savoring different types of food. It's a few blissful hours where we stare into each other's eyes like we're the only two people in the world. When we're feeling more adventurous, we'll do a picnic. When we're feeling cozier, it could be as simple as sharing glasses of wine on the deck. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. Doing something big like a concert or a gallery or event, we usually save for the weekends, and we often go in a group with friends. But our weeknight date night is always special because it's always just the two of us. In one of our infamous first videos, guys recreate Kim Kardashian's butt photo, Zach asks, "Where's Ned?" And Keith says, "He went on a date with his wife." And then everyone laughs. But that part is true. I had to leave early. This was while Keith was rubbing oil on Zach's naked body.
You missed out on a good oily time, bro.
What can I say? Date night's important.
When Ariel was pregnant, we realized that so many of our favorite date night activities involved drinking wine. It was difficult to go to our usual spots, but not drink. So we ended up trying out and discovering new spots that didn't serve wine. And they were just as fun. We definitely went back to our old standbys once the baby came. The baby has made some of the logistics around going out in the evenings more difficult because of the dreaded process of finding a babysitter. Recently, Eugene, someone who is pretty anti-baby, watched Wes for the first time. He walked in wearing a suit and walked out wearing an unbuttoned shirt covered in spit up. Even though Eugene is skittish around babies, I would absolutely let him babysit Wes again. Same goes for Keith or Zach. It takes a village, and we need all the help we can get. Luckily, both our sisters now live in LA as well, so usually one of Wes's aunties babysits while we get to spend time together. Wes loves his aunties, and he loves his tri-uncles too. One of my absolute favorite dates with Ariel took place in Chicago very soon after we first started dating. We had plans to go see Avatar in IMAX 3D, but it was sold out. The evening may have ended right there, but instead we ate crab cakes, drank Chardonnay, and laughed at each other's silly jokes in British accents. Then, we noticed that a DePaul University homecoming dance was being held in an upstairs atrium that same night. Being young and brash, we attempted to crash it. Pretending to have stepped out for a second, we checked our coats and walked right past the ticket tables like we'd been there for hours. We got halfway across the dance floor when I felt a tap on my shoulder and a security guard said, "Do you have tickets?" And in some of the quickest thinking I may have ever done in my life, I replied, "Oh yes, of course, they already took our tickets at the other entrance." He and I stared at each other for a few long, cruel seconds. Then, he bought it.
"Okay, have a nice night."
And we did. We danced like no one was watching for approximately 2 hours and 42 minutes plus previews until the next showing of Avatar.
You know you're in love when you can't fall asleep because reality is finally better than your dreams.
Dr. Fucking Seuss!
Zach tries a romantic gesture. Maggie and I, moving in together to what charitably can be called a fixer-upper apartment, coincided with the Try Guys launching our new company and YouTube channel. I was the busiest I've ever been in my life at a time when so much needed to be done to make our new apartment a home. Maggie is a registered nurse who puts in 3 overnight shifts a week. That means during all the repairs and furnishing and deliveries, she was the one who was home and taking the lead. It was easy for me to justify it. I'm incredibly busy, I'm not good at this stuff, all the obligatory defenses. But Maggie took on that burden without ever complaining. In my sea of responsibilities, I'd found myself neglecting my most important job of all, being a great boyfriend. So I decided to tackle a week of sweet and selfless gestures, putting her first and making time for her no matter what. For this endeavor, I'm focusing on things I totally and completely suck at. Decorating, organizing, cooking, planning. I do realize I'm just listing out basic human functions, but that should give you an idea of the place I'm coming from. The goal is not only to surprise Maggie with things she doesn't expect, but to really give her the things she deserves. I chose things that, in an ideal world, should just become commonplace in my behavior. And in doing this, I hope to evolve as a boyfriend. Because if I don't, it's only so long until she realizes she can do better. The plan. Maggie is working 3 overnight shifts in a row at the hospital, which gives me ample time to pull off some fun little surprises. I want to do all the things she normally handles in the house. Things she does for herself, things she does for me, and things she does for us. And then, I'll throw in some things neither of us does for good measure. Meal prep, finish some house decorating, shower her with surprise treats, and end the week with a romantic home-cooked dinner. Ready? Game on. To start, I wanted something that would alleviate stress from Maggie's life. I had never meal prepped for myself before, which means, of course, I'd never meal prepped for another person either. Cooking for Maggie would be a gesture equal parts sweet and practical, and would save her from whatever horrid cafeteria food she'd otherwise be subjected to. Plus, when we moved in together, we made a pact to start cooking more meals, a promise I'd yet to fulfill. This gesture was a way of telling her I was committed to our shared goal, and that I was going to take time in my life to make it a priority, to make us a priority. As it turns out, I had no idea what meal prepping is. I thought you cooked one thing, but then magically you were left with four different meals. Like, you cook chicken and dice all the same veggies, but then it yields a taco bowl, a stir-fry bowl, a salad, etc. You know, I'm not sure how that would work. Probably witchcraft? But apparently, no. Meal prepping is just making a ton of one food and separating it into different bowls, which is so stupid. Why is there a name for that? That's not meal prepping. That's having leftovers. If that's meal prepping, I've literally only ever meal prepped. It is insane how stupid I am, considering how smart I am. So there I was, in the supermarket, an alien visiting Earth and trying my hardest to just act cool and not get noticed for being a complete imbecile. It took me a full Earth hour to find all the ingredients I was looking for. Keep in mind, I chose the simplest recipe I could find for stir fry and vegetables. Baby steps. I unloaded at home, and that's when I realized about half the things that took me so long to track down were things I already owned. Still struggling with object permanence. Also, I didn't own a pot big enough to boil noodles. So it was back out, this time, to Target. Maggie loves Target. It's her happy place. I promise this isn't an ad, but she's a hashtag Target girl. You know, the kind of person who goes there to clear her mind? Not me. Even the idea of shopping makes me anxious. Normally, I would beeline to an employee and ask to be pointed to the item I need, not bothering to stop and look at the large signs dangling over every aisle. But since I was at Target to shop for Maggie, I wanted to shop like Maggie. I'd walk around and let the store find me. And then, maybe, I could learn what she loves so much about this place. So next time we come, I can live in the moment and enjoy it with her. I found the pot pretty immediately, but I luxuriated in my experience and ended up finding a ton of other great things we needed for the house. String lights and command hooks for the back patio, a fetch toy for Bowie, kitten print pajama pants, those were for me, some decorative fake plants, and some wall art. That last one was a risk. We've certainly disagreed on art in the past, but I was confident this one fits squarely in the snug pea pod where our taste Venn diagram met. Also, with Target's amazing 30-day return policy, you don't even need a receipt, so there's nothing to lose. Shop smart, shop Target. Not an ad. By the time I got home, it was 10:30 p.m., and I got to cooking, which only took me four times as long as the recipe suggested. Liars. My packaging of the meals didn't quite match the pictures online. It was like if someone put all the ingredients in a bag and shook it up real good. But I was done and had four equally portioned meals set aside for her. And my chef's sampler nibbles told me that it was pretty damn tasty despite some small missteps. It turns out, love was the secret ingredient all along. Aww, Zach. I cleaned up the dishes and tidied up so that Maggie would return from shift to a lovely home. I created a bundle from the fake plants and stuck the branches in a large empty vase we had. Wow, Zach, look at you go! And made a delightful pumpkin vignette by the front door. There was a dumb little grin on my face the whole time. I was doing things I absolutely hated, but I was doing them for someone I loved. When I surprised Maggie with her prepped meals the next morning, I started tearing up. Holy shit, I'm such a loser. But I was emotional. It felt like saying, I love you for the first time all over again. But this time I was saying it with my actions. She didn't tear up, but she did laugh at me for crying, which is the appropriate reaction. There's a reason I love her. But she was touched by all the gestures, and the big hug I got really made the whole thing worth it. She didn't mind all the mistakes in my cooking, and she certainly had some notes on my decorating, but the warmth my actions commanded almost canceled out the imperfections. Which is a relief, because the next day I totally burned our salmon. How's that even possible, you might ask? To which I'd respond, I'm a pretty special breed of human. What struck me is that she tried to tell me this was all unnecessary. That the meal prep was so sweet and thoughtful, but that I shouldn't feel like I have to do things like that for her. But of course, I don't feel like I have to do these things for her. I want to do these things for her. When you're in a relationship, sometimes it's the selfless, no reason acts of kindness that are the most impactful in really expressing how you feel. The next day, I hung the new art in our apartment. I learned an important lesson about how stud finders work and the significance of drywall. But nothing a little plaster can't fix. Turns out my floors are slightly sloped, meaning that mystery bubble you use to level things is totally useless in my home, so I just had to eyeball it. I ran out to Maggie's favorite ice cream shop and stocked the fridge with vegan fudge and rosé frosé. I may or may not have snuck a small bite of both, to make sure it was to her liking, of course. Ironically, a long weekend of preparing things for Maggie put me behind at work. My meal prep was listed as a 45-minute start-to-finish meal, and I managed to spend like 6 hours on it. I wish I were kidding. Shopping at the home goods store, hanging photos, realizing they're not level, taking down the photos, hanging them again, trying and failing miserably to string lights along our balcony so we could have a romantic dinner outside. Yeah, that took me an entire day. But the real lesson I've learned is more important. It's not about stopping everything I'm doing and throwing my life out of whack to make her happy. She never asked for that and would never allow it. Instead, it's about finding ways to make some of these habits stick and to work sweet gestures into the flow of everyday life. Once the long weekend was over, I wasn't done. Just as my job and my health require dedicated focus every day, so too does my relationship. And that's so much bigger than anything I could fit into this book. It's the little things. I now wake up earlier and take care of all the morning dog chores before I go to work. I do her laundry without being asked, and only occasionally destroy her delicates. I surprise her with lunch when she wakes up the day after a night shift. Or I even work in a 5-minute foot rub before I go off to work every morning. I gave my first one last night, but will spare you the details of my girlfriend's feet. I did watch a YouTube video for some tips and look forward to having a bizarre suggested video section for the rest of time. I've learned that part of being in a relationship is practicing selflessness, and there's a balance to that. Sometimes doing things for Maggie at the expense of my own time is kind of the whole point. And she definitely does the same for me. I'm constantly asking myself if there's something I can do that'll make her smile, or make her happy, or make a facet of her life easier. It's not wasting time when you're doing something for your ride or die. I love her, and doing things just because it might make her smile is the whole point. This is something I've really struggled with in the past, but I'm starting to see it, and I'm starting to get it. I think back to the romantic gestures of my childhood, and to that young dweeb who tried to sweep classmates off their feet. The whole time, I was really looking for shortcuts. Again and again in dating, I haven't wanted to put in the hard work. Romance isn't all flowers and vacations and meeting at the top of the Empire State Building and running to find her on New Year's Eve. It isn't bursting through the chapel doors to object her marriage to the wrong man. It isn't being an insomniac in Seattle. It was none of those things I saw in the movies that populated my childhood. And it definitely wasn't whatever creepy Valentine's Day stalker packages I tried pulling. No, it's just choosing to put her before myself. It's the little things, the hard things. It's a million unromantic gestures. It's learning how to share your life with another person and doing everything in your power to make them happy. And then, maybe once in a while, you surprise them with a cruise to Ibiza. I needed to take that crucial step forward as a boyfriend, but I lacked the tools. I think back to my fears of moving in together, my anxieties of not being ready for marriage or having children, of not being the man she deserves. But ultimately, it just requires dedication and belief. Dedication to her, putting her needs before my own, and loving her always through ups and downs, when I'm being stupid, and the very rare occasions when she's wrong. And belief. Belief that I am valid, that I'm worthy of being loved, and that there's a reason she's with me to begin with, that it's not just some mistake. Meeting Maggie was, I repeat, the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Let her know it every day, and don't fuck this up, kid. What we learned. Dating is all about confidence. Don't think too much. Don't spend more than 15 seconds crafting a text message. Prepare to be shot down and then brush it all off. You never know when you're gonna meet the one. Love finds you at the most unsuspecting moments, and sometimes in a gay bar bathroom. It's okay to go to bed angry with your Siggy of, as long as you talk it out the next day. Date night is a simple and easy tradition to always make sure you're taking stock of your relationship. So are date lunches. Relationships are about respect, compromise, and selflessness. If you can master that, you never have to watch a cheesy rom-com again. You don't have to, but still can, because they're still delightful.
Chapter 6. Family. They say friends are the new family. I mean, we're not sure who they is, but they sound pretty reliable. For us, the labels friend, family member, and coworker get all jumbled up and basically mean the same thing. But what about our actual families? You know, those who raised us. Remember those people? The four of us have all been guilty at times of not being the best brother or son. We're really busy and there's so much Netflix to watch. Plus, we get complacent. It's almost like the closer the bond with someone, the easier it is not to check in regularly. It's not like your mom is going to disown you. Probably. So we want to look at the, let's call them complicated, relationships we have with our families. How we let them down. How they let us down. How all of that reflects poorly on us. And what we can do about it. We're regretting this already. What's wrong with us? While the other guys surely have domestic problems of their own, I'm the only one with the literal papers to prove it. My parents were immigrants, and I grew up in a town where no one looked like me. Check. I'm a child of divorce from a home that broke up and scattered across the globe. Check. I hate unwarranted hugs. Triple check. You could not write a better backstory for a character with a simmering suspicion of affection. I've always had a hard time expressing my truths to my family. My parents didn't hug me every night. Instead, they conditioned me with values of achievement through diligence and action. Rather than coddling my dreams, they made me prove that I had the mettle to successfully reach my goals. Say what you want about Asian Americans or families from similar cultural backgrounds. We get shit done. And the one thing we sacrifice is emotionally opening ourselves up. Yes, my family and I love one another, but our particular way of showing it smacked of the formality one would associate with colleagues in a business setting. We were Korean, Texan, conservative, Christian, and desperately trying to fit in. In hindsight, my parents raised us this way to not only survive our surroundings, but also to progress far beyond them. And it worked. My sisters and I are at the top of our respective fields. And if happiness were truly defined by success, then we should be leading blissfully jubilant existences. This, as we all know, is never the case. And although the foundation on which we constructed our social personas was made up of cold, hard, impressive steel, it doesn't erase the hot, fiery, emotional furnace that burns within each of us. My family, and the generations before them, because of this instinctive need to, first and foremost, stay alive, were never taught or allowed to channel the warm, desperate need for sentimental validation. And so, when I came into this world, feelings ablaze, an unmanageable artistic force, I was pressured to keep it all under wraps. I tried to lock it up in a small, concrete box in the center of my heart, without instructions on how to properly allow others to take a peek inside. I was an adult beyond my years in so many areas: school, self-reliance, intelligence, aptitude. But like so many kids whose family's focus was on career over playtime, I was woefully unprepared and infantile when it came to making friends. It wasn't until I broke that concrete box in my heart and allowed my passion and sensitivity to flow through my work that I started to manage my relationships in a more healthy, controlled manner. But what's left is that hole. Many of us carry around that gaping, empty space where the box used to reside. And as charismatic and well-adjusted as I may appear in videos or in person today, I continue to be wary of the people who enter my orbit. Hell, I'm even heedful of my own flesh and blood. I am a product of divorce, after all. Siblings fight. Marriages fall apart. Families are bound by an imaginary idea. Blood. So I'm going to try to close the gap between me and my family in a way I've never attempted. I'm going to allow myself to be intimate and sentimental and open through the help of my friends. This is going to be an absolute nightmare.
You know, we don't talk a lot about our families in the Try Guys. That's partly because it doesn't come up a ton in the content of our videos, and partly because it's not our right to talk publicly about our family members' lives. Yes, I'm aware of the irony that we're about to do just that. I'm aware. The Fatherhood series is the most we've spoken about our families since our dads were a part of those videos. One of the biggest revelations in that video is that my family doesn't say, "I love you," to each other. It's something I always wondered about but never thought to ask my dad until then. And he said it simply came from not wanting to embarrass my brothers and me, and it just sort of stuck, which I suppose I can accept. My whole family is independent. My two brothers and I all live across the country from each other, pursuing our own lives and goals. I don't talk to my parents a ton. I used to chat with them on the phone roughly every other month, while Becky and her parents talk on the phone almost every day. Only recently have I begun chatting with my mom somewhat daily. However, it's literally Facebook chat, and they are only sort of exchanges like, "Hi, what's new? Not much, bye." But I like that it gives us a lower touch way to communicate. We're all busy people living our own exciting lives, and we still care about one another, but this is how we exist as a family. But I feel like I should challenge this notion. So far, what I've learned from writing this book is that our habits and preferences are just what's comfortable, but that ultimately you choose what your habits are and what comfortable really means. Just because my family and I have never really kept in touch that much, it doesn't mean that it has to be that way forever.
Some of my friends talk about not showing or vocalizing affection with their families, which I find insane. Not because I'm judging, I'm not, but just because it's so foreign to my family's dynamic. We hug, we kiss, we share blankets on the couch, and we definitely say I love you, oftentimes as a corollary for saying goodbye. My parents, ever the supportive pair, are also probably the two most dedicated Try Guys fans on the planet, with apologies to everyone else. My sister and I don't fight. My cat ruled the house with a commanding but gentle fist. We were a tight-knit and loving unit, just teetering on the edge of nauseatingly cute. They all put up with a ton of bullshit raising me, all with a smile, and believe me when I say I was not an easy kid to raise. Throughout the years, my parents have encouraged a few of my admittedly insane life and career choices. There wasn't even much of a hesitation when I started doing some of the more, let's say, out there, on-camera antics. One of my first YouTube appearances involved tattooing a smiley face on my ass, filmed for millions of people to see. People always ask if it's real. Yes, it's real, and yes, it's still hilarious. I feared a huge lecture, but was met with more of an eye roll. My parents are cool. And they respected me and my sister enough to not micromanage and to let us make our own decisions. Mistakes. Throughout childhood, instead of telling me that I should stop filming my toys and focus on some real hobbies, my parents helped me double down on being a total goof with after-school activities aimed at feeding my creativity and alternative pastimes. They didn't just help shape me, they totally enabled me, in a good way. My younger sister, Stephanie, and I, incongruent to the basic fundamentals of siblinghood, have always been close and we seldom fought. It's not a stretch to say that she's my best friend. She was my first audience and I made it my job throughout childhood to make her laugh. Now, I'm not talking cheap gags like making fart noises with my hands. No, this was highbrow stuff. Like, okay, get this. Putting a pillow over my head and bumbling around the room, knocking into things. Mr. Pillowhead crushed every time. My mother, in a stroke of genius, was able to preemptively extinguish any sibling rivalry, jealousy, or possessiveness by turning everything into a game. She told me that my new baby sister was going to try and steal all my toys, and that I could trick her by pretending to be into something else super useless. As a result, anytime Steffi got grabby, it just turned into a joke instead of a fight. That is some next-level parenting ninja shit right there. If you get one thing out of this chapter, let it be this. Trick your children into not fighting by being smarter than them. I've only recently come to recognize how much of a role my family played in shaping who I am, and I can't say I've done enough as an adult to properly thank them. Hearing the other guys talk got me thinking, and I imagine some of you out there are like me. You say, I love you, out of muscle memory, instead of feeling the weight of the words. The impact my family has had on my life has been profound, and as I've grown older, I've slipped into periods of being distant, of not calling as often as I should, and of not expressing how much they mean to me. It's something I need to rectify, especially now that we're all adults, because time is precious, and I want all my future I love yous to be impactful and sincere. A brief history of trying. On one hand, Liam and Noel Gallagher of the band Oasis fucking hate each other. They have been ripping into each other in the press and to each other's faces since the early 1990s and have reportedly brawled on multiple occasions. On the other hand, Wonderwall.
Meet Wesley!
When Ariel and I welcomed our first child, Wesley, into the world last year, let's just say we were not prepared. I don't think parents are ever truly ready, but because Wes arrived nearly a month early, we were definitely not ready. Ariel and I had been putting the boards on the beautiful new deck that her father had built, pretty much entirely by himself. I mean, the man's a machine. Throughout the day, she occasionally complained of cramps, and as the afternoon wore on, she started doing less drilling of screws and more organizing of tools. Then, she took a long bath and went to bed early. That evening, at midnight, she started having contractions. For the first 2 hours, she furiously Googled phantom labor pains and downloaded an app to time the contractions. Around 2 a.m., she woke me up to say, I think I might be going into labor. That was the last thing I was thinking. Since it was nearly a month before her due date, I thought I could give her a shoulder rub and we would both go back to bed. But the contractions seemed to be getting worse. Finally, Ariel suggested we go to the hospital. We were so woefully unprepared that we had to print out a packing list from a doula website in order to figure out what to bring. We hadn't even picked out a name for our baby. I drove carefully to the hospital, thinking that the last thing I needed was a 3 a.m. on Saturday collision with the drunk driver. I even pulled over to the side of the road a few times so that Ariel could bear out a contraction. We were checked in, and the nurse wouldn't let Ariel eat or drink anything because of a potential emergency C-section. She checked Ariel's dilation, 4.5 centimeters already. I'll never forget when the nurse said, "Oh, honey, you're staying with us tonight." We moved from triage to the labor and delivery area, where it was much more comfortable, and where there was even a couch for Dad. I was Dad everywhere we went. Initially, I kept thinking, "I'm a person, and my name is Ned." But that night, Dad it was. I quickly grew to love it. Soon, it seemed like the tension of an emergency had been diffused. Ariel was allowed to eat and drink again, and they set up a nitrous oxide tank to help with the labor pains, which nitrous was Ariel's preferred pain management technique. That's when I watched the nurse set up a table containing what looked like 1,000 tiny knives. In reality, it was a delivery table with a dense array of tiny scalpels, scissors, gauze, and paper towels, but in my sleep-deprived state, I thought it was a harbinger of death. With Ariel lying back and nitrous flowing calmly into her lungs, I stared at this shiny, shiny death table. The labor went on, and on, and on. Throughout the morning, we tried different labor positions. On her side, with a squishy ball between her legs, facing backward and gripping the edge of the bed, bouncing on a ball, standing up and leaning on me, leaning over the bed. Despite our exhaustion and her pain, we laughed and held each other. We must have played the entire Ed Sheeran discography about 3 times. But after 12 hours of labor, her water still hadn't broken. The doctor finally arrived and got to work. She slipped a little plastic stick inside Ariel and, pop, water was suddenly pouring out of her. It was a puddle about an inch deep. Sorry, listener, these are the things that you will need to know eventually. After that, the pain